This is the last week that we'll spend in our obituary series. This is where we're talking about legacy. I bumped into a funeral director at the grocery store. I have four sons, so I'm at the grocery store a lot. And I bumped into him there, and he said, "What are you guys doing at your church this month?" And in terms of your sermon series, and I explained to him that we were talking about what kind of legacy we want to leave in our life as we kind of walk through the various parts of a person, anybody's, average person's obituary. He said, "Well, I've had multiple calls from your parishioners to call us to talk about pre-planning for our funeral." He said, "Do you think you could do that series about four times a year?" I recently buried a really, really good man. Used to sit right over here. Found us through our Biker Sunday service. You know, every so often we have like 2,000 bikers, and every so often we have one or two kind of hang on. He was one of the ones that kind of hung on. And came back, and he had been battling lung cancer for a number of years. And he would come in often when he would go to the doctor. He lived out in the country, and he would come into town and go to the doctor, and often he would stop here at the church and he would go into the sanctuary and pray, just going by himself and pray. And he would poke his head in the office, and if I was there, he'd come in and we'd sit down and we'd talk. He told me that when he was a young man, he left his home in rural Kentucky, and he said he came up to Lima, got a good job in one of the area plants, and made a good living for himself, came with absolutely nothing, and was able over the course of his life to make a good life for himself. But he said when he left Kentucky, he said what drove him was he had just they had just celebrated a funeral in his family, and for the first time, because he was older, the family came to him looking for a donation to help pay for the funeral costs for the family member. And as he asked around, he realized that this was how they did it. And he decided he wanted to be the first person in his own family to pay for his own funeral. And so he drove up here, made a new life for himself, and he told me actually on his deathbed, he said, "I made it," and I knew what he meant. And along the way, he paid for a number of funerals for aunts and uncles, nephews, nieces, brothers, sisters. He had the sense that he wanted a better life for himself, but not just for himself. Today, on our last stop in the series, we want to talk about living a life of generosity. And I want to begin in, you know, we had a really good time, the first Bible study this past Tuesday. We were talking about death in the Old Testament. Spent a lot of time in Sheol, and which is where you went. That's where they believed you went when you died, Sheol. Now we're going to move into the New Testament. We're going to talk about Gehenna. You would rather go to Sheol than Gehenna. Let's just put it that way. Gehenna is a Greek word that means burning trash dump, right? And so we're going to talk about Satan, and we're going to talk about all that stuff, and as we kind of keep moving into the New Testament and how our view of what happens to us after we die, talk about how it's changed over the course of history. But as part of that, we spent a lot of time in the Old Testament, and there are a lot of ministers that are down on the Old Testament. A lot of Protestant ministers now, and it's because people can get hung up on certain.
Maybe I need to take a hint. We just end right here. But they're kind of down on the Old Testament because God can be pretty vengeful and can be pretty wrathful. And we talk about the prophetic view of the world. We talked about that this past Tuesday night. The prophetic view of the world, which dominates most of the New Testament, this idea that your punishment you get in this life, not in the next. Everybody just goes to Sheol after they die. Good, bad, indifferent. Doesn't matter what nation you were from or whose God you worship. When you died, you went to Sheol. But your punishment was in this life. And so the Old Testament looks, you know, it's the God of the Old Testament is kind of hard for a number of people who are New Testament people to understand. But, and there are certain laws that people focus on in the Old Testament. You know, there are Ten Commandments, right? That were handed down to Moses from Mount Sinai. But in addition to those Ten Commandments, there were 613 laws in the Levitical Code. Did you know that? 613 laws. They dealt with everything. Some things dealt with the clothes that you wear. If you wore a shirt this morning that was a polyester cotton mix, you just violated the Levitical Code. If you had lobster or shrimp last night, you just violated the Levitical Code. If you had a cream-based gravy that was on your potatoes and your beef, you violated the Levitical Code. Can't have meat and milk on the same plate. A lot of laws governing every facet of life. And there are certain laws that people like to focus on, particularly at this point in history. There's only three or four laws in the Levitical Code that deal with the issue of human sexuality, specifically homosexuality. People like to spend a lot of time on those. But you know what? We ignore most of the other 613. The vast majority really deal with the issue of justice. You know, Jesus was not informed by the New Testament. Jesus was not raised with the New Testament. There is no New Testament for quite a while after Jesus dies, rises again, and ascends into heaven. Jesus is informed by the Old Testament. So is the early church. And so this understanding of who God is comes out of the same scripture, the same Levitical Code, the same books of history and poetry and prophecy. It's informed by those same books. They don't have Matthew. They don't have 1 Corinthians 13, love is patient, love is kind. They don't have the book of the Revelation. Their understanding of who God is and what God wants comes out of the Old Testament. And much of the Levitical Code is focused on the issue of justice. One of the key pieces of the law was this idea of the year of Jubilee. It was this idea that you could not buy or sell land because you did not own it. And it comes from an important place. Remember Israel, they had been slaves in Egypt. Remember the story of Joseph? Remember that story? Joseph in the multicolored coat? Remember that one? Did you see the musical? Did you see the Disney film? So, you know, musical made Donny Osmond famous again, right? Filled up his bank account. God bless Donny Osmond. And so Joseph and his 11 brothers. They were all the son of Jacob, whose name would be changed to Israel. And so they were all the sons of Israel. And two of them, he and his brother, Rachel was their mother, and the other 10 brothers, Leah was their mother. And his father loved Rachel, but he didn't love Leah. And so the two brothers got spoiled. and the 10 brothers got jealous. And Benjamin was a lot younger than his older brother, so Joseph was the one that got spoiled first. The reason why he got that multicolored coat was because his father bought it for him. It'd be the equivalent of, like, on Christmas morning, if you had 12 kids and they were all gathered around the Christmas tree, 10 of them would get underwear and one of them would get a new iPhone X. And then the baby got, I don't know, diamond-encrusted rattle or something, I don't know. But the 10 brothers were sick of the way that their father treated them as opposed to Joseph, and so they were going to kill him. They lured him out in the middle of nowhere and they were going to kill him, but a slave trader happened to come by and they thought, well, why not make a few dollars? We'll sell him to a slave trader and then we'll just lie to our father and tell him that he's dead. And Joseph went to Egypt. And he was a slave in an important man's house, and he did a great job because he was smart, and he was intelligent, and he was gifted and capable, and pretty soon he had the household humming, and he was managing their business affairs, and they were doing well. And unfortunately, the man of the house, his wife, kind of took a liking to Joseph, and she wanted him to do unspeakable things with her. He was a man of virtue. And he turned her down and they ended up throwing him in prison. And it looked like the story was over, but because he was gifted in a myriad of ways, one of which was the ability to be able to explain dreams. He explained this dream. Remember, Pharaoh had this dream. 7 fat cows came up to 7 skinny cows and they said, "Eat more chicken." No, that's not how it goes. This service brought to you by Chick-fil-A. It's not open today. No, the 7 fat cows go to the 7 skinny cows and eat them, right? Nobody can figure out what that means. Joseph says what's going to happen is going to be 7 years of plenty and 7 years of famine. What you want to do is you want to build big storehouses and bring in all the extra grain in those 7 good years because people are going to need it in the 7 bad ones. And Pharaoh is so impressed that he puts Joseph in charge of that. He's like second in command, this Israelite slave. And who ends up wandering in during the famine but those brothers, right? Those lowlifes begging for food. Joseph's a lot better man than I am. He just toys with them a little bit. But ultimately, he ends up bringing his whole family, including his beloved father who thought he was dead. And they came and they settled in Egypt. And Pharaoh gave them choice land, we're told, near the Nile River. So it was very, very fertile. And the Israelites, the children of Israel, they prospered. And they continued to grow wealthy and they grew in numbers. And they started buying up more land. And pretty soon, where there were dozens, there were hundreds. And where there were hundreds, there were thousands. And, you know, time passes. We kind of forget things. We kind of forget stuff. Like it happens and it's a big deal for a while. And then our memories are short. And even though we write stuff in history books, we forget about it. And pretty soon, many pharaohs down the line, the pharaoh didn't care what Joseph had done for his country. He just knew that those Israelites had all the choice land, and he wanted it back. So what he did was he levied new taxes on them, and they got into debt. And when they got into debt, they had to hand over the ownership of their land to Pharaoh. And after they handed over the ownership of their land, they were still in debt. And so they ended up having to sell themselves into slavery, and then they could never get out. And it's this experience that Moses had, this history that he knew, when he sat down and he listened to what God wanted for his people. It's this experience that's fresh in his head when he writes down these words, "I own the land, not you." If you sell land, what you're doing is you're selling the crops. Because at the 50th year, every 50 years, All the land goes back to the original owners. This is about justice. The Levitical code ensures there will never be super rich and powerful people. Instead, what it'll ensure is that people will embrace and live out the virtue, the first virtue of fairness. So if you sell the land with 22 years left before the year of the Jubilee, as opposed to 7 years left on the Jubilee, then you're gonna get less for your land at 7 years than at 22. Because they've only got 7 years left to reap those crops, and the other person has 22 years to reap those crops. But on the 50th year, it's a reset. All the land goes back to the original owners, because it's not owned by them, it's owned by God. See, we're supposed to understand that all things are owned by the living God. And He wants us to take care of that which has been given to us. And specifically, He wants us to take care of one another. And so in all of our financial affairs and all of our business dealings, we're supposed to ask the question first, is this a fair deal? Fair for him or her, or fair for me? Both. Is it fair for them, and is it fair for me? Is it a fair deal? It's not like Pharaoh setting up a tremendously unfair deal because he knows what it is that he wants. It's not an exploitative system. We're supposed to act fairly. And Jesus knew this. On the flip side of this, Jesus also understood that when we're talking about fairness, we also need to think about generosity and hospitality. So that there will be people who have much and there will be people that'll have little. And they're supposed to share with one another. And even if you have very little, if there's somebody who doesn't have a lot or has nothing, you should still share with them. So he's got this fairness, this idea of fairness and stewardship in his head when this guy asked him about this inheritance that he wants from his brother. Jesus is like, listen, don't worry about what it is that you get or what it is that you don't get. Worry about the ethics of how you manage what it is that you have been given, because it's not yours. If you become all enamored with whatever it is that you accumulate in your life, at the end of your life, you're going to die broke. But you won't die broke responsibly. See, here's the thing, man. When I do a funeral, it's touching the things people put in a casket. People put all kinds of beautiful things in a casket, things of meaning. Do you know how many of those things the person in the casket will need when they are buried in the ground? Zero. And so the idea is that while we're alive, we're supposed to cultivate this attitude of generosity, of hospitality. So Jesus is trying to convince the disciples, it's okay, I know you're out here going town to town, sharing the gospel, and you're not back fishing, and you're not back tax collecting, and you're not back farming, you're not doing the thing that makes a living. Don't worry about it. The hospitality of the people will take care of you. Because these are God's people, and they have been taught to be hospitable, so that when somebody comes into a community and they have nothing, the people of the community will take care of that person, whether they are a member of that community or not, whether they are Israelite or a foreigner. See, that's the ethic that comes out of Levitical code. We don't own anything. So we're supposed to engage in our business dealings both in an attitude of fairness and generosity, hospitality. Don't worry. People in that community will take care of you. That's who we're supposed to be as a people of God. My grandmother always told me the stories about the Depression. My grandma Booker. Grandma and Grandpa, I never met Grandpa Booker. He passed away while Dad was still in high school. But I knew my grandmother well. Mowed her grass and painted her porch, and she was the best cook on the planet. And I used to go over to her house, and she would tell stories about the Depression. Have any of you listened to stories about the Depression? Poor young kids, never going to hear a story about the Depression. They lived on the 1100 block of South Union, which is kind of across the street. It just sits back behind Main Street, which was right across from the locomotive works. So there were a lot of guys during the Depression who were riding the rails because there was no work. So you would go from town to town and you would look for some sort of work so that you could feed yourself. And so she would tell the story that every so often someone would wander from the rail yard across Main Street, cut through the backyard or through the alley behind the house, and go through the backyard, which was a garden. Correct, Father? The backyard was a garden. Do you remember weeding in that garden? Did you get paid a penny for a whole bucket of weeds? 10 cents. I think when I was a kid you told me it was a penny, but keep my allowance down. But they would come in through the back gate, and they would go up to the back door and knock on the back door, and maybe they would do some weeding, or maybe they would pick some beans. If there was work to be done, then they would do it. And while they would do that, my grandmother would go in and fix them a plate. And she got a little mark on the doorpost. If you come to this house, you will receive hospitality. Now, my grandmother was not a rich woman. The Bookers on South Union Street were not rich. I've heard many, 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 many stories. If we gave the microphone to my father, he could tell all of them to you. And that has been imprinted on me, but in a time of great need, even though they had little, there were others that had less. And they still gave it away. See, the next verse after in Luke, after the one that was read, it keeps going. After he talks about this parable of the rich man who like stores up all of his treasures, and then his life, he dies, and you know, he dies broke, even though he's got a warehouse full of grain, and he's got 7 60-inch flat LED, ULED, 4K TVs, and he's got a summer home, and he's got a winter home in Florida, and he's got a timeshare in Hawaii, and he's got a beautiful 1967 convertible Cadillac, and he's got all the stuff. When he dies broke. Can't use any of that stuff anymore. And Jesus goes on and tells the disciples, "Therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat, or about your body, what you will wear. For life is more than food, and the body more than clothes. Consider the ravens. They do not sow or reap. They have no storeroom or barn, yet God feeds them. How much more valuable you are than the birds. Who of you, by worrying, can add a single hour to your life? Since you cannot do this very little thing, why do you worry about the rest? Consider how the wildflowers grow. They do not labor or spin. Yet I tell you, not even Solomon in all of his splendor was dressed like one of these. That is how God clothes the grass of the field, which is here today and tomorrow is thrown into the fire. How much more will he clothe you, you of little faith? And do not set your heart on what you will eat or drink. Do not worry about it, for the pagan world runs after such things, and your Father knows that you need them. But seek His kingdom, and these things will be given to you as well." See, there's injustice in the world. You are part of an unjust economic system, and there's nothing you can do about it. Or is there? You're You're part of an unjust economic system where they're exactly what God doesn't want when he talks about the year of the Jubilee, super rich and powerful and a whole bunch of poor people that live all across the world. That exists now and you're part of it. But the question is are you going to cooperate with it or not? If God has blessed you, how fair will you continue to be and how hospitable will you continue to be with your great blessing? Will you be a good steward of what it is that God has given you? A good steward of your life and of your time? Everybody here who has accomplished anything in life is in debt to somebody else who has poured themselves into them. Whether it was their parents or their grandparents or some mentor in their job or a teacher or a professor or somebody who showed you the ropes of sales or whatever it is. Somebody. You stand on the shoulders of somebody else. And now God has given you a great responsibility. So will you be remembered for your generosity? Will you heed the words of the Levitical code and the prophets who warn people against violating it by becoming Pharaoh? That's the last thing in the world you want. You don't want to become like Pharaoh. Where all of a sudden, your advantages you use to manipulate things so that it benefits yourself, and other people have to pay the price. You want to be fair. You want to be generous. You want to be hospitable. Be a good steward. Are you a good steward? That's the question I want to leave you and myself with this day. Are you a good steward?